And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Nature has the capacity to evoke and provoke passions within most of us, especially those who tie their deepest feelings to the wild creatures. In just a moment, we explore the realms of the passionate warriors as we look at whales, riders, and woodpeckers, and the people who forge beyond the boundaries of ordinary man. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Humanity is either drifting into uncharted waters, or perhaps is more like rocketing into the unknown as the 21st century looms before us. We drift because we seem to have lost our plan. The usual visions and dreams, like democracy in Iraq, aren't so clear-cut, don't necessarily carry the human spirit that once it did. And rocketing, as we are on a natural trajectory, that we may be incapable of changing much, as the power and energy unleashed in the 20th century launch of the modern age now pushes us into a new world of rising oceans and global warming, mass extinctions, and to a large extent, we will just have to go along for the ride until we find a new and more powerful technology to lead us onward. Sometimes, the best way to know where we may be going is to watch for the trends, which can morph into trendy, which may have the good fortune to become fashionable, which then leads the masses along until the fashion changes. Well, the good news for all of us is that nature and a passion for nature are becoming interesting and even somewhat okay and perhaps even trendy. Getting on board the ark to the land of sustainability carried on the winds of global warming, is definitely becoming fashionable. And until it is abused, this can only serve us, and if we are smart, we'll ride that wave for as far as it rolls. Today, we're going to visit a few passionate warriors, as we talk about a nature riding workshop in our third segment, and get brought up to date on the latest fieldwork coming from the Choctahatchee swamps in the quest for that elusive ivory-billed woodpecker thought to be extinct, but recent reports of its existence are engendering great passion, particularly in the team led by Dr. Jeffrey Hill. We'll cover his latest discoveries following the news and continue into our second segment. But today's news is really a feature, which relates directly to today's theme, as this week, in the waters of the southern Arctic Ocean, passions collided, literally, as pro-whaling and anti-whaling forces faced off in a most amazing story, which we'll get into right now. And what played out in the Arctic Oceans may be likened to an off-Broadway play of great consequence. The stage. The cold, sullen blue oceans which hug the Antarctic. The actors. The legendary eco-warrior Paul Watson in the role of captain of his ship, the Farley Moad, along with his supporting actor Captain Alex Cornelison, commanding his ship, the Robert Hunter. They have come to the vast open Arctic in the hopes of finding the Nishin Maru, pride of the Japanese whaling fleet, which hauls up and flenses the great whales it catches into blocks of meat and blubber, oil and blood. In the name of science, they seek out, harpoon, and drag hundreds and hundreds of whales that live in these waters, set aside by the world as a sanctuary from slaughter, to allow the great creatures to recover from the blind greed of centuries that decimated the once great pods to light the lamps of the world. In Act 1, Captains Watson and Cornelison forge their craft into the open seas to find the whaling fleet. For 5 weeks, they churn their craft, ever searching, And then, Act Two. The chase was launched, and once undertaken, the great whaling armada took flight, with the Nishan Mara full steam away. But the Farley Moat, no small vessel by any standards, kept at the chase, and the whaling ships abandoned the whales to take flight, avoiding entering the ice, as they call it, where ships become toys on the Arctic stage. But the great Captain Watson had done this all before. This was his passion, saving the whales, and he'd run alongside the whalers, ensnarling their props with nets, fouling their decks with rancid butter bombs, and over the years, no one had ever lost a life on either side. And in the pursuit, Zodiacs were enlisted, small craft, launched to tease and tattoo the whaling vessels. But in the fray, a Zodiac craft broke down amidst the fog and snow of the frigid fray, and drifted off unknown to the captain's all, drifting into the fog. And as fate would have it, in this moment, the phone went dead on the little tiny Zodiac. And their silence, the silence of lost sailors at sea, rang out like a chant from the souls of all lost sailors. And silence fell to the battling Titans as all ships, yes, all ships, held fast to take a break to find the lost sailors. Hours passed. 3, 5, 7, 8. And then the men were found. And then they were saved. And so the truce was ended. And as with any great chase in the wild, the pursued are eventually cornered, up against a threat of ice in this case, and blocked from escape by the Farley Moat and the hunter. It was the Kaiku Maru that was being steered into the ice, and faced with the ancient fate of being beaten, the Japanese captain, running full steam with the Robert Hunter, veered starboard, and the great ships collided in a slow-motion grinding and ripping of steel plates and nerves. The ships were slapping each other like schoolyard boys, afraid to throw the first real punch that would ignite the pride and fury that fists ignite when pain and passion collide. And around the world went out, "Fight! Fight! There's a fight in the Arctic!" And the great ancient parents came running to break it up. And the great ancient parents were forced, finally, to speak out, to stand up. And the great nations shamed the Japanese for loving whales in soups and in cans more than free and in the seas. And the principals of the schoolyard, the New Zealanders, in whose waters the fight erupted, agreed finally to protect the helpless beings in their charge. And the battle was drawn. And the sea shepherds retreated, battered but finally honored by a world that hoped this would all just go away. But it won't. For the world is awakening to the songs of the giant souls that seek sanctuary from the slaughter, so that they may raise their young and live their ancient lives, thrill the human soul, and express the will of the divine in the ways we may never really understand. Thank you, Captain Watson. Thank you, Captain Cornelison, for standing up for the rights of the living, even on the vast small stage of a cold and distant place that few would ever ponder in the raging seas of change within which we drift until someday we find our way back to the garden, back to an Eden so crafted in love. And that's the news. And a few reminders. If you have a story to tell, a passion to share, contact me here at the Wildside News by sending me an email to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. We'll be glad you did. Now, continuing on with our stories of the passionate warriors, we drift Atlanticwards to Florida, where a curious passion is being lived out in some ancient and remote swamps. It's an update on the search for the ivory-billed woodpecker. We're into February here, and spring is in the air, at least in some areas, not in others. But in some areas, yes, spring is beginning to appear, and with that come increases in certain bird activities and migrations and movements and things. And certainly one of the areas where people are most interested in what may be happening in that realm is in an area in the panhandle of Florida, the Choctahatchee River area, because Dr. Jeffrey Hill, who is joining us now, has set up a crew based on graduate students and other people to head down to that area to try to determine whether or not that elusive, supposedly extinct, ivory-billed woodpecker is, in fact, not extinct. Dr. Hill, welcome back to the Wild Side News.
Hey, Sydney. Thanks for having me on again.
Yes. Last time we talked, you'd gone down to that area. You picked up some sightings and soundings, and we'll talk about those, which inspired you to really head back into that area, and certain things you perceived suggested that there was a good reason to do deeper research. And so we're going to talk about that and find out where you're at. Let's talk, first of all, about the ivory billed and just give a brief history. And I encourage listeners to go back to a previous show, which we have on the show page here, to get the background. But just give us a brief reintroduction to the ivory billed, and we'll lead into where you're going now.
Okay. This is a very large species of woodpecker that lives in southern swamp forests. And it was widespread, if not relatively common, before the Civil War. And this was largely because the southern swamp forests had remained pretty much intact up till the Civil War. But after the Civil War, northern corporations got their eye on the southern swamp forests and started harvesting this resource. And over the next decades, into the early 20th century, they basically cut all of the cypress trees and many of the other swamp species trees out of these southern forests. And as the swamp forests were cut, ivory bills became scarcer and scarcer, rarer and rarer. And then as we get up into the early 20th century, there was a lot of interest in natural history collections. And both professional museum people and rich amateurs basically put out a bounty on the remaining ivory bills, and shooters went through the remaining swamp forests and ivory bill populations and just about shot every bird. So coming out of the early 20th century, ivory bill woodpeckers were largely thought to be extinct, although they were never officially declared extinct by the Fish and Wildlife Service. There was no definitive evidence through the second half of the 20th century. And then in 2005, the Laboratory of Ornithology at Cornell University announced that they had discovered at least one bird in Arkansas in the Big Woods area there along the Mississippi River, and that they had video as proof of the existence of one bird. And it was really their announcement that got us poking around a little bit in South Alabama and the Florida Panhandle, and we stumbled into a population of ivory-billed woodpeckers on the Choctahatchee River.
By the way, what's the update on the lab's work on the ivory bill? I haven't heard much about it.
Well, they were very frustrated in Arkansas and being unable to relocate the bird that they photographed in 2005. And the probable explanation is the single bird that was in the Cache River during that spring moved elsewhere, either died or moved. And with that bird gone, the Cache River is a relatively small area. There were no ivory bills left to pretty easily locate. Uh-huh. And so the idea is that these birds may still exist in the White River bottomlands, which is a vast forested tract south of the Cache River. And their investigation and search for ivory bills in the White River area continues. Cornell is also trying to spearhead a continent-wide search for remaining ivory bill habitat and remaining ivory bills. And so a lot of their effort now is focused on having search teams kind of jump around the country going from one possible ivory bill site to another.
Of course, the great big twist on this story is the fact that it had been 40 years at least since the last time there was a definitive sighting of an ivory bill. And then you kind of wonder, well, after 40 years with no sightings, how could it be that there's possibly only a couple of birds left? It doesn't make sense because they have to...
these are the things that's the skeptics have really latched onto. But, you know, these southern swamp forests are bigger than people appreciate.
Yeah.
They were cut over, but in many areas they weren't clear cut. They were the big valuable timber was taken out, but forests were there before the cutting and there after the cutting, and very few people with book knowledge of birds ever get near these southern swamp forests.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've talked to people who have fished and are part of a continuous lineage of fishermen and hunters along the Chuctahatchee, there seems to be a fair bit of knowledge of the existence of ivory billows. It's not a surprise to the local people.
People there are reporting that they do see them.
Yeah, after the fact, we had never had any reports of that Chuctahatchee. But now as we go around, it's not uncommon to run into a local fisherman who has very little awareness of our search or what's going on, but will tell you, oh, yeah, I've seen these birds my whole life. You know, they used to nest down there, and then they were up there, and they give us good descriptions. They seem to know these birds.
This is a definitively significant bird because it's a very large, very...
Well, it's large, you know, but for a non-birder, I think sometimes how fantastic this bird is maybe a little bit overstated.
Could be, yeah.
You know, it's not like a whooping crane-sized bird.
Right.
About a crow-sized bird.
Well, I know I've run across pileated, or pileated, whichever they are, woodpeckers, and walking in the woods, and I'd never seen one before, and the first time I saw it, I went, what in the world is that?
You're very aware of outdoors, and so ivory bill is slightly larger than a pileated, and for somebody cued into birds, you say, wow, that is a big woodpecker.
Yeah.
For someone with no interest in birds, it's like, huh, there's a bird.
Right.
I don't think it would stop the non-bird enthusiast in their tracks screaming, oh, God, look at that bird, which is sometimes the way this bird is portrayed. It's a heck of a bird for someone paying attention to their environment around them.
Well, also, they look so unique. They look almost dinosaurial.
If they're close on a tree next to you, they have the herky-jerky movements. Yeah, that catches people's attention. They do look pretty interesting when you get a close view of them.
Now, I'm talking, of course, about which is the proper pronunciation?
Pileated? I say pileated, but... I'm self-taught birder, so I probably pronounce it wrong. I hear both from expert ornithologists. That is an English word. Probably could look it up in the dictionary.
Yeah. Well, we'll say pileated.
Get a correct pronunciation.
We'll say pileated just because it's easier.
Yeah.
Pileated sounds a kind of fancy.
Yeah. I'm not fancy, so I just stick with pileated.
Let's move up, because what you're now looking for is the ivory billed, which is a little bit larger version and has distinctive patterns, which, of course, is what birders are always looking for. Give the definitive distinctive patterns for the ivory billed.
Okay, ivory billed is larger than pileated. In length, maybe 10 to 20% larger. It's more massive, though. It weighs substantially more. And ivory billed basically has a lot more white in its plumage than pileated. Although this is tricky because pileated show a fair amount of white, and people consistently misidentify pileated as ivory billed because they see the white.
Well, that's the conflict.
The big difference is on a perched ivory bill, the lower half or lower 30% of the back is gleaming white, sort of like a red-headed woodpecker perched. On a perched pileated, there's very little white, a little patch of white at the base of the primaries. So if you get someone who has some ability to describe the birds they're seeing, and it's funny how people will misdescribe a bird right in front of them, but if someone is a reliable describer of birds, if they note a large patch of white on a perched bird's back, that's a very distinctive appearance of this bird.
Well, that's the critical bit of information a person needs. Of course, then they have these extraordinary beaks, long beaks, and then the crest.
That's right.
Yeah.
But most of those characteristics are shared with pileated.
Yes, they
pileated
are.
Pileated tend to have a darker bill, but it can be fairly light, never ivory color, but fairly light, and especially if the sun glints off it can look quite light.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not as good a character. And then the crest, they both are crested woodpeckers, so it gets tough beyond the white on the back. For people that aren't experienced bird watchers, that can take detailed notes on the bird.
Okay, well, there you have it. So if you're out in the woods, you see a large woodpecker, and you notice the white, you're probably becoming part of history. The white back. Lots of white
back on a perched bird. business.
There you
right?
go. There you go. Okay. Well, that's what people keep your eyes open out there. Well, let's talk about what you've done since we last talked. You mounted quite an expedition to the Choctahatchee River area. And tell us about how you got out there and what's been happening since then and how you're going about your field research.
Yeah, well, this year we've got Brian Rolek back. He worked as just a technician last year, but he's now my graduate student. And I recruited another graduate student, Rusty Ligon. And so Brian and Rusty run the field crews. And our field crews consist of about 10 paid searchers. So these are mostly college kids, although not all college kids. Some older people came in to be part of this. And they basically are paid to be in the swamp all day, every day, trying to get a picture of ivory-billed woodpeckers.
So you've got about 20, 30 people out there?
No, closer to 15 people.
15 people, okay.
Yeah, with counting me and Dan Mennell and our two grad students and a couple people doing the sound work, it's closer to 15. And then we don't work 24/7. We basically work during a week. Everybody gets 2 days off.
Mm-hmm.
So at any one time, there's closer to 10 or maybe a few under 10 in the swamp at mm-hmm. any one time.
And then how big an area are they distributed over?
Well, we're trying to cover about 12 square miles.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it seems like an enormous crew down there, we sometimes feel overwhelmed. We have a presence of less than one person per square mile
mm-hmm.
most days. So a lot of people have raised concern that maybe we have too heavy of a presence in the swamp, we're saturating the swamp, and it doesn't feel that way most days. One person per square mile is not a very heavy presence in that swamp.
This a square mile is a big area.
Is a big area, yeah. Especially in a swamp.
Yeah, exactly.
A square mile in a salt flat is
yeah.
pretty big. A square mile in a flooded forest feels orders of magnitude bigger than an open field or something. It's so hard to move, no line of sight. And a square mile yeah. can feel like an enormous area.
And obviously the nature of sound in those areas as well must be very different.
Yes, very different. Very hard to locate. Sometimes you hear the double knocker cant, which you suspect might be an ivory bill, and everybody thinks, well, just run towards it and get a picture. Well, it's tough. Usually there's deep water channels between you and the bird, or you're in a boat and there's dry land between you and the bird, and it's just tough to move quickly through this habitat.
So you have your field workers out there. They're living in tents. I mean,
that's right. We work out of remote tents. Mm-hmm. We have a generator, so they do have electricity,
mm-hmm.
but that's it. You know, no running water. We just have pit toilets that we dig, and they're really living in a remote camp situation.
I think it's great. If I were in a different situation, probably a lot younger and a lot more able to do whatever I wanted to do, I'd be out there with you. I can't think of anything more exciting than that level of field work. And you pay these guys. I mean, they're paid.
Not much, but they do get paid.
$1,200. I tell you what, for sitting out in a tent, there's not a lot of way you can spend your money out there.
Low overhead.
Know? Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I wish I had more nights in the camp. It is a really fun atmosphere.
Yeah.
Because they're very enthusiastic. Group of people, hardworking, and the nights around the campfire cooking dinner in our little kitchen area is really an enjoyable time.
Well, we've painted a picture. Now let's talk about what they're out there doing and how they spend their days and what you're finding. And we will, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.